Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Thank you, Jay. Coming up on today's programme, yesterday women took to the streets of Iceland on the anniversary of the Women's Day Off strikes in 1975. We'll be looking at how the nation celebrated as a global leader in closing the gender pay gap still has a 14% pay discrepancy between men and women. One of the central tenets of any democracy is that no government can introduce legislation to bind the hands of future administrations. Why then does Brazil's President Michel Temer seem so set on a fiscal cap on public spending which would last 20 years? The British government has announced plans to commit British troops to train opposition forces in Syria. It reportedly comes at the request of Washington. We hear from the former British ambassador to Syria later in the show. A recent surge of Cubans making the journey to Florida Straits has emboldened critics of the infamous wet foot, dry foot policy. We'll be hearing from a special report from Jack Foster later on. And... sorry, all that and more over the next half hour. The sounds of hundreds of women on the streets of Iceland yesterday on the anniversary of the Women's Day Off strikes in 1975. The Women's Day Off was a large-scale walkout spurred on by campaigns across Europe to combat gender inequality and the gender pay gap. 41 years on, Iceland is currently the global leader in the World Economic Forum's Gender Pay Gap Index and has been for 6 years. It's been voted the world's best place for working women, yet it still has a 14% gender pay discrepancy. This itself is lower than the European average, which currently sits at around 16%. But with a 14% pay gap in the world's most equal nation, what does that mean for the global campaign for gender equality? Iceland was the first nation to democratically elect a female leader, the first nation to have an openly gay head of state, and along with other Nordic nations, is looked to for inspiration by many women's movements around the globe. One of the policies often highlighted as being a pivotal moment in the fight for gender equality was the introduction of mandatory paternity leave. Getting rid of the idea that a man was more employable than a woman, as a woman may have to take time off work to have a child. Earlier, I spoke to Nanna Arnardóttir, a journalist and author, and began by asking her if, given Iceland's ranking as a world leader for gender equality, there were still a large grassroots movements within the country.
I think so. I think that Icelandic women in general are feminists. I mean, it's like any place, right? But I'd say the majority of women, certainly the majority of women that I know are feminists. But, you know, when you look at the world, you know, saying that Iceland is a leader is, it's great and everything, but the bar isn't really, like, it's not super high. So it's not like we're clearing this great bar. I mean, the gender wage gap in Iceland is 14%. And the EU average is 16%. So, okay, we're doing a little bit better, you know, and sure, oh, you know, it's deceptive when people say, we've got the best, we're the best place for women to be. I mean, technically that's true, but we're not doing that much better than the rest of Europe.
Well, the gender pay gap in the UK is 18%. Now, we had a gender equality bill passed in Parliament for the pay gap 4 decades ago. Is it difficult to maintain motivation and optimism when we're looking at decades and decades of activism and still a huge gap in gender equality?
Well, I mean, so the first step is always the law. No matter what it is that you're trying to achieve, the first step is to get a law that makes, you know, wage inequality illegal, right? And then it's just a question of enforcing it. And I think the way that our society is built up and the way that the UK is built up, when I lived there at least, it makes it really hard to enforce. And I think one of the reasons is, for example, the fact that paternity leave isn't mandatory, and it's, I don't think it is at least. So but at least, you know, paternity leave is not as great as maternity leave is. And, you know, as long as there is still an incentive to hire a man over a woman, because a woman may end up taking time off to take care of her kid, you know, there's not going to be an incentive to close that gap, because it's, you know, still going to be, you know, easier for an employer to hire a man. And another reason is childcare. So I know that in Iceland, childcare is heavily subsidized by the government. And that means that over 90% of mothers in Iceland are have full-time employment or are working full-time. And in the UK, I know that's not the case. And that's because childcare is so expensive, it's not financially viable for women to work because, you know, their salary ends up going into childcare. So they're like, what's the point? I can either spend time, you know, one of us, the mother or the father, can spend time with their kid full-time, or, you know, you're both working and one of your salaries are only going to childcare.
The word feminism itself is a word which is largely misunderstood and has a lot of negative connotations attached to it quite often across Europe, and we experience it here in the UK. Do you think that people who don't have a clear grasp per se of what feminism is might be quite surprised that paternity pay is instrumental in the journey towards gender equality?
Like with anything, if you walk someone through it, they're going to embrace it. It's a simple explanation for why, you know, women struggle for equality. It's one aspect. But it's easy enough to, it's like anyone would understand it. They just don't think about it. It's not, most of what gets in the way of people grasping what feminism is are not obvious problems. People are blinded by privilege because, you know, it's hard for a guy, you know, who to see, you know, inequality in their day-to-day life because it doesn't affect them directly. You know, if you've moved through life and you go home at night and you never put your keys between your fingers to be safe, or you've never been followed, or you've never been catcalled, then it's difficult for you to understand that somebody's living that way and that it might be uncomfortable for someone else, for a woman to walk home late at night if you've never experienced that.
Ever since Michel Temer took over as Brazil's president following the controversial impeachment of his predecessor Dilma Rousseff, his opponents have accused him of anti-democratic behaviour and a desire to impose a right-wing agenda on Brazil in lieu of any electoral mandate. Creeping privatisation of the state-owned oil company Petrobras, as well as offshore oil reserves, took place early on in Temer's administration, but now it seems he's looking further into the future. Jack Foster has more.
To say that Brazil's President Michel Temer is a controversial figure would be an understatement. He's the embodiment of the successful movement to impeach the country's democratically elected leader Dilma Rousseff in June of this year. His opponents have accused him of leading a coup d'etat, and in his first 2 months at the helm of the Brazilian economy, he's been proactive to say the least. But one policy which could even cause raised eyebrows amongst even his own supporters is the proposed implementation of a fiscal spending cap designed to limit public spending for not just the duration of his presidency, but a full 20 years. Rodrigo Nunes is a political analyst at the Pontifical Catholic University, and he joins me on the line now from Rio de Janeiro. Thank you for speaking with us today, Rodrigo. One of the fundamental pillars of democracy is that no government can enact legislation that will bind future governments. With that in mind, how can the Temer administration be about to institute a fiscal spending cap that will last 20 years?
Well, I suppose you should ask them, not me. But the answer is relatively simple. This is what they were placed there to do, namely to implement reforms that PT couldn't anymore, either because of the pressure from its social base or because of it had lost the political conditions. So, truth be said, there was already a version of this bill during the rounds during Dilma's term. So, this is not an entire novelty, but this is precisely the thing that PT couldn't do, and this interim government, precisely because it isn't elected, and precisely because it's in all likelihood not going to run for elections next, is expected to do. And they have the perfect political opportunity for that, which is a major economic crisis. And as we've seen all over the world, this is precisely the kind of opportunity that finance and the financial markets and the neoliberal ideologues generally take advantage of.
You said before, of course, that the Temer administration is not technically elected. In such a scenario, you would imagine that kind of administration to be quite cautious, quite conciliatory, steady the ship, keep things going until the next election. Temer has been anything other than cautious, though, and you kind of hinted towards it there. But, I mean, does that... I mean, not perhaps exactly this legislation, which, as you say, had been around for a while, but there has been a race to privatise quite a lot of previously nationalised things in the short time since he's become the president. Is that a coordinated ideological push?
Well, it's not only ideological, because what we need to take into consideration is the fact that this government's position is actually a lot less stable than it might look at first. Of course, it does have a lot of support in parliament, and it does have strong support among markets and big business, etc. But it has a very limited amount of time to introduce the sorts of measures that the people who supported the impeachment have placed this government there to implement. And on the other hand, it's under constant pressure from corruption investigations, which in the last week or two have actually moved closer to the very head of the government, not only one of the most important figures in Temer's cabinet, but also quite possibly Temer himself. So they know that if they can't deliver what is expected of them, then it's highly likely that they will be thrown overboard like so many other people have in this process. And right now, what we're having, the fact that they're trying to push, the very first reform that they're trying to push is precisely the most extreme in the package that they've been discussing, is a test of force. They're trying to see how far they can go and what they can do. And their calculation seems to be that obviously PT has imploded. So the party who in the past would have been traditionally organized a popular social base against this kind of measures hasn't loaded, doesn't have the mobilizing power that it has in the past. The left in parliament is completely demoralized.
Well, Rodrigo Nunes, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, the British government has announced plans to commit British troops to train opposition forces in Syria. The move reportedly comes at the request of Washington. We hear from the former British ambassador to Syria in just a moment. Given the continued thawing of relations between the US and Cuba, you'd be forgiven for thinking that there'd have been a drop in numbers of Cubans seeking refuge in the States, but not so, apparently. In fact, US authorities have suggested that recent events have actually seen a spike in those attempting the crossing. Later in the programme, we'll be asking why. And how did 85,000 bottles of whiskey get lost in a river? You couldn't be blamed for thinking that the steady improvement in US-Cuba relations would signify the lifting of the embargo and an improvement in the economic conditions for the average Cuban. However, there has actually been a recent surge of Cubans making the journey to the Florida Straits, emboldening critics of the infamous wet-foot, dry-foot policy. Jack Foster has more.
10 Cuban migrants land at Dania Beach, Fort Lauderdale, kissing the sand as they jump from their small boat before being detained by police and, as you can hear, about 100 onlookers cheering them on. Of course, for Cubans seeking exile in the United States, to reach the shore means a great deal, not least because it draws to an end several days of dehydration aboard a tiny boat, but because it almost certainly guarantees them a fast track to US citizenship. Oddly, had these same migrants been stopped just a few metres earlier before their feet touched the shore, they'd have been automatically returned home to Cuba. That strange dichotomy in the way that people fleeing Cuba are treated by the US is due to what's known as the wet foot, dry foot policy, whereby a Cuban caught on the waters between the two nations with wet feet is sent home or to a third country, whereas one who makes it to shore with dry feet gets a chance to remain in the United States. The policy wasn't always this this way, and in fact it grew out of a much more liberal policy towards Cubans seeking refugee status in the US, whereby pretty much anyone who could make the journey was eligible. This policy was at its absolute height during a mass migration of asylum seekers known as the Mariel Boatlift.
Between midnight and noon today, 23 boats filled with over 800 Cubans reached Key West, Florida. U.S. Marines are now on duty at Key West to keep order among the restless refugees waiting resettlement in the United States.
The Mariel Boatlift is estimated to have brought over 125,000 Cubans to Florida, and Cubans continued to travel to the U.S. in large numbers for years after. But President Clinton sought to normalize migration between the two countries during the 1990s, a part of which involved agreeing to no longer permit Cubans intercepted at sea entry to the U.S., as well as capping the annual amount of immigrants from Cuba. For those who saw the Cuban administration as oppressive and dangerous, this was a controversial move in some quarters of U.S. politics. Here's Indiana Republican Representative Dan Burton speaking at the time.
Your boss called it a brutal dictatorship, and yet we're returning women and children, many fleeing for their lives, back to this guy, and we're saying, you know, he's going to treat them all right.
Of course, that was a fear that wasn't fully shared by the Clinton administration at the time, as illustrated by the then U.S. Undersecretary for Political Affairs, Peter Tarnoff.
The experience that we have had since September 9 of last year, when tens of thousands of Cubans have returned to that country, indicates to us that with respect to this narrow band of issues, the Cuban government has held to its agreement not to have any reprisals against the people who have been returned.
So the wet foot, dry foot policy has continued to endure ever since, despite its flaws and despite perhaps most glaringly the recent softening of relations between Havana and Washington, culminating even in a state visit by President Barack Obama to Cuba earlier this year.
El futuro de Cuba tiene que estar en las manos del pueblo cubano.
And since that historic thawing of relations between US and Cuba, logic would dictate that Cubans would be less likely to make the dangerous crossings than before, and logic would dictate that they'd have less reason to do so. But according to US law enforcement agencies, this past year has seen a surge in Cuban migrants trying to make that crossing. 5,396 were intercepted at sea this year alone, with around 1,000 making it to shore with so-called dry feet. How long exactly the wet foot, dry foot policy has left, especially given the change in relations between the US and Cuba, is anyone's guess. But it seems as though Cubans are keener than ever to take advantage of it.
For more on this, Matthew Eaton spoke earlier today to Anthony Capsir, Professor of Latin American History at the University of Nottingham.
So what exactly are the origins of the wet foot, dry foot policy, and why has Cuba exclusively been granted this status?
Well, it all dates back to 1966, actually, with the Cuban Adjustment Act, an act which is still in force, which gave the Cubans that unique right. And it was a deliberate attempt to force a brain drain, to undermine the system. At that stage, there were all sorts of US government-backed initiatives to sabotage, undermine, weaken, and besides the embargo itself. And that was a very obvious factor. Now, what happened was it remained pretty much the same until 1994, when a flood of emigrants taking to the seas on boats and flimsy craft, August, September 94, when they threatened to flood Florida with would-be migrants. And indeed, to some extent, they were allowed to do that by the Cuban government, which saw an opportunity to force the pace on migration agreements. And it worked, because the net result of that was that the United States government immediately came back to the bargaining table, to the negotiating table, and agreed a variation of the existing very flimsy, very thin agreements that were there, which said that any Cuban found moving towards the United States, migrating illegally on the seas but heading for Florida, would be returned to Cuba, hence wet foot. And anybody got to the United States by any means whatsoever would be allowed as before.
And what do you think is causing this recent upsurge in Cubans seeking refuge in the United States?
Yeah, it's recent. It actually dates back to, of course, to December 2014. Namely, it's immediately the declaration of impending relations was made. many Cubans interpreted it as meaning the inevitable end of that special status. And so they decided to speed up their process of migration, not particularly to escape Cuba, but to get into the United States with that particular status so that they wouldn't be simply branded like Dominicans, Salvadorians and everybody else.
Does it make legal sense for a country which is in the process of normalizing relations with Cuba to still have a policy that can fast-track citizenship for Cuban exiles on the grounds of political asylum?
It makes very little sense at all, but then there's quite a bit about the current relationship that doesn't make too much sense, unless you remember that the embargo itself is not only still in force, but is pretty much solidly in force as well, and is the central political issue in the debates in the United States and in political circles, that is, not economic circles, about relations. Because the talk of normalization actually, of course, is slightly misleading, because all that's normalized is the diplomatic relationship. And obviously, the mood music has changed. But the embargo is still there, and people are still being penalized for breaching the embargo.
Okay, Anthony, thank you very much for your time.
You're more than welcome.
The British government has announced that its troops are to train Syrian opposition fighters. The decision is believed to have come in response to a request from the Pentagon. In October 2015, the White House abandoned a similar effort after it emerged that only a handful of fighters had actually been trained. The renewed deployment comes at a time of intense international rivalry for influence in Syria's prolonged civil war. For more, here's Liam O'Hare.
Well, the decision to deploy troops is likely to attract controversy following the defection by moderate rebels to more extreme groups in the past. A similar British mission alongside the Americans ended in November last year after US-trained fighters surrendered to Jabhat al-Nusra, an al-Qaeda affiliate, on the Syrian border. Around 20 military personnel drawn from a number of units will be sent initially, but the numbers are expected to increase in the future. And for more on this, I'm now joined by former British Ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. Peter, thanks for joining us on World in Focus. What's your reaction to the news that British troops are to be redeployed to train opposition forces in Syria?
It raises many questions. The first and most obvious question is perhaps how we can be sure that these new trained elements will not simply join the war in Syria, not to fight Daesh, as Mr. Fallon claims, but to join their rebel partners in operations all over Syria. If that's the case, then we will just be stoking the fires of war, adding to this dreadful dynamic of outside interference, leading to further outside interference, and just prolonging the agony of the people of Syria. And if we take it at face value that these fighters will fight Daesh, how is that going to mesh with the operations of the Peshmerga and Turkey, who, it will be recalled, are fighting each other? The whole thing is a sorry mess, and it seems to me a great pity that we are dabbling in affairs that go beyond us and only prolonging the misery of the Syrian people. There's also the consideration that we are dragging Jordan further into the mire by conducting this training in Jordan. Jordan in recent months has been trying to back away from the conflict and has increased its cooperation with Russia. A move like this will just drag Jordan closer to the burning fires in Syria.
You were obviously the ambassador to Syria a number of years ago. If you were in that position just now, what would your advice be to the British government?
Think again before it's too late. Do not be so subservient to Washington. This move comes as a result of a request from the Pentagon. We should use our own judgment and not allow ourselves to be dragged into dubious moves by the Pentagon, who suspended their own program a year ago because it was such a dreadful failure that they only managed to put five, that is, five, not 50, 500 or 5,000, but five individuals back into Syria to carry out what they were trained to do. That program was begun again in July with no signs that it's being any more successful.
That was Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria. And earlier I also spoke to Nadeem Shahadi, the director of the Fares Centre for Eastern Mediterranean Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. I asked him for his opinion on the British and American initiative to train opposition fighters in the country.
It's not a bit of a sham. It's a big farce, in a sense. And I would love someone, you know, I'm at the university, and I would love someone to do their thesis on the mechanism of this, because the Americans spent $500 million, and in the end, they effectively trained 3 rebels. So they trained 60, and from those 60, what remained was 3, because the others defected. And it was because the way this was done was totally absurd. They were told to hang around, not do anything until they receive orders from above. The vetting process was also a bit surreal in terms of, if you're on the ground fighting a revolution, your town is being bombed, and your whole purpose is to defend your family, your town, and you get asked these questions and put conditions that you cannot fight the people who are killing you. It's a bit of a farce.
So I guess the United States in particular has been used to being the hegemon in the Middle East over the past couple of decades in terms of the interventions that it's led. Do you believe now the US is in a bit of a difficult position in Syria, and that they don't actually have a clear strategy outlined?
Yes, I think that's an understatement. I think now the Russians control the game in Syria. The Americans are leading. The Americans are being led by the Russians in the negotiations. John Kerry, in a way, repeats all the narrative that Lavrov gives him. This is how it looks, and it looks really bad. Just to give you a snapshot, the Russians gave the Americans 2 hours notice before they intervened in Syria with their air force in September last year, and they gave them 1 hour to clear off airspace, whereas the West, if you like, the Americans and their allies, who are supposed to help the rebels, have been talking about no-fly zones and protecting civilians for 5 years.
Spaccio is not your average pizzeria run by former drug addicts as part of a rehabilitation program in Italy. A nationwide poll run by the food website Gastronota has just placed it as Italy's finest pizzeria. The pizzeria is owned by the Comunità di San Pantragano, a major Italian rehabilitation centre located in Coriano near Rimini. Since its inception in 1978, San Pantragano has specialised in treating people with drug addictions, including society reintroduction via training schemes. And now the award-winning restaurant plays a vital role in the community. The restaurant manager, Giuseppe Morghese, told one of Sputnik's reporters earlier today, quote, 200 people have so far been able to return to society thanks to the professional training received in our pizzeria. Spaccio was born to give residents of our rehab centre concrete training opportunities in the catering sector. Society reintroduction is indeed one of the most delicate passages once a drug addiction recovery programme has been completed. Spaccio is not alone. Pay it forward in community-run restaurants and cafes are becoming more popular around the globe. Edinburgh-based social project Social Bite employs homeless people and gives all profits to charities and community initiatives, and in the last year attracted a special visit from Hollywood star George Clooney. So sometimes it really does pay to help others. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. And finally, usually at this time in the show, we would leave you with a lighter story, perhaps something a little bit funny to leave on a high note. Today's supposedly light story is one I personally can't find all that funny. Somehow, a whopping £1 million worth of whiskey was lost after a major leak at a Scottish distillery. Loch Lomond distillers in the west of Scotland are reported to have lost around 60,000 litres from their warehouses in Ayrshire after a leak went unnoticed in one of the company's giant vats. The loss, the equivalent of 85,000 regular bottles of whisky, sparked an investigation by safety experts and environment watchdogs, and they've discovered that a lot of the whisky had drained onto the ground, and the rest has found its way into the local River Ayr. Well, at least there might be some very happy fish in Scotland tonight, and I am off to the River Ayr to test the water samples. That, unfortunately, is all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. You can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, goodbye.